We finished up last Wednesday talking about really the boundaries of the Promised Land, and I'm going to go ahead and scoot on to that section. We have talked about the Garden of Eden and briefly what principles we can learn from the Garden of Eden. So I'm not going to stop. I'm just kind of giving you just a moment to kind of see what we've covered. The days of Noah, of course, and the mountains of Ararat that are supposed to be the location where the ark rested. One of the things you might find interesting when you study Bible geography is varying locations pinpointed on the map of how people spread out. And so you've got the mountains of Ararat here, which in my mind is kind of north of the Promised Land area, of course, obviously north of the Ur of Chaldees and so forth, where Abraham comes from. And you're going to get further south, really, with Bible history. We don't come back to the mountains of Ararat in this location, geographically speaking, and talk a lot about this location in Bible until we get really to the New Testament. In the New Testament times, you've got the seven churches of Asia Minor, Ephesus, Laodicea, Smyrna, Philadelphia, and the ones I'm not thinking of. And those are in kind of this area, mountains of Ararat, the northern area. So again, this will be just an interesting progression. Well, we talked a little bit about the supposed finding of the ark, and of course, I'm not convinced. The Tower of Babel, of course, an interesting study about languages, really. We talked about languages. So if you're taking notes, remember, I think the highlight principle is the idea of being able to communicate in a pure language. Zephaniah talks about there being a restored pure. See, other people were coming in too. I'm so thankful that I wasn't the last person anyway. All right, so anyway, the Tower of Babel, we talked about that. Now, city of Ur, Abraham's first home. And what's one thing that stands out about the city of Ur? Anybody, it's a kind of a random question, but just, pardon? Copper? Sure. Jewels? Anything else? What about a very advanced city? That's right. Exactly. And so what did Abraham have to give up, or Abram, when he was asked to go to a land that he had never even owned? In fact, today we'll talk about this. Anybody know what piece of property Abraham ever owned in his entire life? He owned one little piece, and he died there, or he was buried there. He bought a cave. Yeah, Machpelah, yes. So we'll talk about that, and that's the only piece of property Abram ever really learned in this land. Of course, the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, tells us that he had a mindset that he was what kind of a person in this world. What kind of a person was he seeking and searching for? He was a stranger and a pilgrim, the Hebrews writer tells us in chapter 11, searching for a city whose foundation and maker was God. That's right. So this is the kind of mindset that Abraham had. Of course, again, these are just pictures of the modern-day findings of the Ur of Chaldees and the location where Abraham was. Now, we talked about Haran. Haran's going to come back up today, and we'll kind of, again, there's a little bit of a cyclical rotation. And if I can effectively kind of put in your mind maybe some of the movements of people and places when you study your Bible, I believe, the next time you go through this in a personal Bible study, you might be inclined to go, that's pretty interesting. I'm going to go back and look at some of that. And like y'all, if you're from the South, or Ewens, if you're from Missouri, y'all encouraged me to think about something last time we studied, and that was the name of cities and the names given, which were keyed to people. And that helped me kind of go back and do some study I hadn't done in a while on regarding like the sons of Noah and how the nations began to disperse after the flood. And that's why we can say very objectively that Noah's sons went this direction, Japheth towards Europe, Ham down towards Egypt, and Shem towards kind of the Ur of Chaldees, the Fertile Crescent area. And we can say that objectively because of names and locations historically identified, which key back to none but Noah's sons. So I want to keep that in mind as we study through some of this. Of course, again, locations here, locations, locations. I'm not going to get bogged down. Now, this is where Abraham lied in Egypt, and just putting up information there on the screen for you, some archaeological information dated to about 2000, which, by the way, last week, archaeologically speaking, did anybody read or see where they had just found a basilique or a carving of Ramses II in slums area? Anybody see that on the news? That just made the news last week, and they're digging it out, and it's a it goes back to the temple of Ramses II, and supposedly Ramses II is the pharaoh or one of the pharaohs involved with Moses and Abraham's day and age. So not far from that, well, in that timeline. You can see kind of right here at the beginning of an ancient temple to a pharaoh, the two individuals posed there. That's what I'm talking about. They found one of those busts, large, buried in a slum area in Egypt. And it's identified objectively as Ramses II. That they just announced that last week. Yes, ma'am. There are mixed up, and yeah, be careful what your kids learn. Study your Bible; it'll keep you straight. All right. So yes, the Plain of Jordan, where Lot chose. Kind of got into this some, and Don Cheek and I last week were talking about this some, and he was talking about how that Fertile Crescent isn't so fertile like it is or was then, and having been over there, and anybody else has been there, you've probably seen this. It may not always look like the Jordan Valley can look on occasion. This supposedly, I didn't take this picture, I found this picture. This picture is supposedly a picture of the Jordan Valley, very likely in a springtime setting when you've had some rains and some various things to help produce the foliage there. But Don mentioned that the salt from that area has really caused a lot of lack of vegetation. Am I right on that? Is that kind of what you were saying? So things changed, and that was interesting to me, too, because of the concentration of salt in that Dead Sea. Anybody ever watched documentaries? Anybody ever seen the Dead Sea? Everybody gotten in that water and tried to go deep diving, and what happens? You can't do it. You float around there. I guess it's fun, but I don't know what that salt does to your skin after a long period of time. But I know it's pretty corrosive. So again, here's just a kind of an animated or artistic rendition of the Dead Sea area, Jordan Valley, a predicted idea of what it looked like during the days of Sodom and Gomorrah. The two locations likely being Sodom and Gomorrah, and I'll talk more about that in just a moment and show you some things that are very evident in that area. Now, Melchizedek. We didn't get to talk much about Melchizedek because of time, and I certainly wish I had time. Genesis 14, we're introduced to this character. Anybody else remember in the Bible where Melchizedek is introduced? Hebrews, that's right. And what kind of a person is Melchizedek here in Genesis 14? Who is he? A priest and a king. He becomes a type antitype. Who's the antitype? The one before the true type. Who is a king and priest? Perfect. Jesus Christ. And also, what kind of a priest was Melchizedek? Was he a priest over the tribe of Levi? No. He was a patriarchal priest. Paid homage to who? Abraham, God's chosen vessel, if you will, for the promise of redemption. And yet, he is someone that we know very little about, but he was a king over Salem. And Salem becomes what city? Jerusalem. Yes, very historically accurate information. You know, one of the things that intrigues me, and I know that it must intrigue archaeology, scientists, and so forth, is with the development of people, these Semitic people at the time were not well known in Jerusalem area. Here at this day and age, you've got Abraham, the chosen one out of Ur of Chaldees to go up over into this land, and that's where your people, Abraham, are going to inherit this land And that's going to be their land. And eventually that's where the Messiah is going to be born, the seed of the woman, and so forth. That's where it's all going to take place, Abraham. Now your people are going to go into bondage for about 430 years, and your people are going to be in a strange land, and strangers, and slaves, and so forth, down in Egypt, and he didn't understand all that. And during all this time, Abraham's family is very small, but they're not from there. And you've got all these people, the Canaanites, the Philistines, and the those people that Hittites, and various peoples that are well known, and that's where they lived, in the Palestine Promised Land area. Now, in a very short period of time, when we get to the Exodus, what we do know is this. The influx, the mass exodus out of Egypt into a land of promise, and all of a sudden you've got all these Semitic people that are there. And archaeologically speaking, they go there and they start digging and they go, well, at this layer or level of archaeological digging, there are no signs of Semitic people. Up here, there's thousands and millions of potsherds, and that's pottery. And idols. These people were idolaters. Did you know that they find more predominantly amongst God's people two different idols in their digs almost every time they dig, from what I understand? You know what those two idols are? You read about them in the Bible all the time. Baal and the feminine version of Baal. God's people. Do you remember Jacob when he finally gets his two wives? He works so hard for Rachel and Leah. And they finally get out of there and they leave their father's place. And do you remember her father chasing after them? And do you remember which of the wives had taken the father's idols? That's right. Rachel, the one who birthed Benjamin and Joseph. These people were known idolaters. And so God, through about 1,500 period of time, while he gives them a law, through Moses, when we get to the Egypt, the Exodus, and so forth, he gives them a law to try to straighten them out, to make them distinct from all the other nations. Hence, that's why they couldn't eat pork. Because what kind of people ate that old dirty, sloppy animal? It tastes so good today, and I'm so thankful I can't eat. But nonetheless, they couldn't eat it because more of an appearance issue, in my judgment, and that's my opinion. You don't have to buy that. You can sell it or whatever you want to do. It has nothing to do with the idea of health. Today, people have said, well, we should go back to a Hasidic or a Jewish dietary rules and not eat catfish. Man, that would be tough, wouldn't it? It had nothing to do with health. It had more to do with the idea of appearance and the idea of cleanliness and all these rituals. Women during their menstrual cycle had to do what? They had to go through a purification. They had all these things, and God was trying to make them pure because they were idolaters. They were pagans. And he was trying to get that out of them, getting them ready for the Messiah. So again, oh, I just get so distracted. But nonetheless, Abraham and Melchizedek, you got a battle that goes on. Lot gets up, gets caught up in this battle. You know, again, we didn't talk a whole lot about Lot, but what happens to Lot as a result of his choice to go into that well-watered valley of the Jordan? When Abraham gave him first choice in his eyes, the Bible talks about he looked out there and saw that well-watered. I mean, anybody would. I mean, I suppose if you saw that, you had the choice of taking your cattle and your animals, and that was very necessary. But does anybody recall the problems Lot had as a result of that choice? That's the first thing we read about. And then over time, what happens in this well-watered, valuable land of Sodom and Gomorrah and so forth? What happens to his family, his daughters? Are they kind of brought up in that environment, caught up in it? And then what happens when finally God says to Abraham, I'm going to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah? And Abraham's mind goes to Lot, no doubt, and his family. And he says, God, please, if there's just 50 people, will you spare those cities? And God says, okay, Abraham, I'll spare those cities. And there weren't 50 people. comes back and he says, God, if you'll just spare those cities, please. And he drops the number. He drops the number all the way down. Do you remember the final number? 10. How many people were righteous? How many come out? Alive. How about Lot's wife? And she looked back. So you see again, the lessons here that are interesting maybe and tie into these lands and locations. So now this is where I was, I think last Wednesday. So here you have Israel's promised land, and this is kind of the outlay of what will become the promised land, and various names. I wish it was a little brighter. And those are tribal locations there. You can't really tell on the right side. It's Manasseh's land. Then you got Gad on the west side of the Jordan River Valley. And then you've got Reuben. Remember, those tribes will not go in. They'll settle there. And then they'll have to go in and fight with Joshua and so forth. But there's some issues. When David takes over, just to kind of advance history a little bit, and we'll come back to this. David here during his reign and rulership will actually capture the promised land as God instructed him to do, and run off all them Philistines and all the enemies of God. And so they're just showing the changing of boundaries and so forth, and how things would fluctuate with this land. So remember, when we talk about the land of promise, we recognize very quickly it's referred to as different things. These names, this might be confusing to kids, by the way. It was to me. I didn't always understand if a teacher didn't specify. We're talking about still the same thing. So the land of Canaan, Palestine, the land of Israel, various names here that are used throughout the Bible. So don't forget that. Another little screen here shot of the land possessed by the Israelites under Joshua, the red line. You can kind of see that. Remember, that's different from the screen I just showed you during David's day, which there's a lesson in this. There's a lesson. God said, I'll give you the land. Did he give them the land? Joshua declares in Joshua 21, Joshua 24, that the land was delivered. Land was given, all the land. Now, it was up to them to do what with the people in the land? To become buddies with them or do what? That's right. But as is usual with people, we probably like to eat their pie too much, and we enjoyed the relationship more than maybe we should or could. I don't know. But now look at the blue line. I thought that was an interesting comparison. Today, that's a modern-day line of Israel, the nation of Israel. So you can kind of put that into context and perspective how things, by the way, everybody knows here that the land today is not, what is the promised land today? I mean, we're all working real hard, aren't we, to get over there? I mean, that's where I want to go and die, right? That's a joke. Randy's up here looking at me, don't you mean heaven? Yes, I'm not, I care, now maybe if they would quit fighting over there and bombing each other, I don't know, I might be interested in going over there one day. I don't know, I doubt it, but I'm pretty happy right here in Texas. Aren't y'all? Yeah. I'm sorry? Yeah, that's right. That's right. The only thing that brings about peace is what? True peace is only delivered through one person, through his message, the gospel of peace, Ephesians 6:15. Yes, ma'am, that's exactly right. So today, the only way to have true unity and true harmony is not through your pedigree. Because I know I'm good looking. You know, actually, Jesus wasn't that good looking according to Isaiah, was he? He was not comely. The word there in the English is used in the King James, comely. And so again, we don't worry about that stuff. All right, now why did that slide? Okay, I messed up here on this one. I didn't do the right. All right, so this is the wilderness of Shur. The reason why I put this on the screen is actually I didn't do the animation right. you can kind of put that in perspective. Anybody recall what the wilderness of Shur is a reminder of? Look at Genesis chapter 16 for a moment. We are on a new slide, a new venture. Look at Genesis chapter 16. And someone tell me who wanders off into this location, verses 4 through 7. Anybody remember who loved Hagar more than Abraham? That's a joke too. Sarah did not like the handmaid. And yet she, trying to appear, showing no patience whatsoever with God, no patience whatsoever, she tells her husband, here's your handmaid, don't like her anyway, but just go ahead and have a baby by her, and we'll get this promise rolling. And as a result, the angel of the Lord tells her in verse 7, finds her in the wilderness by the fountain in the way to Shur. Wouldn't it be interesting to know where that fountain is, if that fountain even still existed, which it probably doesn't. That's the location she ends up in that area. Now, trying to be as brief as I can and show timelines and maps and all this, but this is when Ishmael is born. The end of chapter 16. Verse 7, the angel sends her back, and do you know how long it is between Ishmael's birth? Look at verse 15 and 16 of chapter 16. I want to just try to point something out here that maybe we missed sometime. Look at Hagar bare Abram a son in verse 15. And Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bare, Ishmael. Which God said the name. And Abram was 86 years old. Anybody know how old that is? Yes, 86. First time I heard 86 and what was Abraham Lincoln. That's right. All right. So, well, by the way, I mean, I've never taught my kids that when they turn 20, they'll be a score old. We don't do that anymore, do we? See how language changes and things change? All right, but Abraham Lincoln was still using that terminology, 1860s. All right, look at now, he's 86 years of age. Look at chapter 17, verse 1. How much time elapses between those two verses and the next verse? How many? 13 years. Anybody know what takes place in chapter 17 after this situation with Hagar and Ishmael? I just want to point something out. After the birth of Ishmael, 13 years elapses. 13 years. And Moses picks up the story by inspiration in chapter 17, verse 1, as we divide it, and he immediately goes 13 years later. Now, what happened during that 13 years? I have no idea. He's got a son named Ishmael that will help bury his dad with Isaac in chapter 25, and so there was obviously a connection and relationship he had with his son over the years and development. So he was not unfond or unkind to his son Ishmael. Okay? But 13 years elapses here in chapter 17, verse 1. And then God renews his covenant with him. You ever get impatient with God, Sarah? Do we ever get impatient with God? You know, I've gotten to where in my life I start putting things into 5 and 10 year increments. And my goals are sometimes set around that because, you know, if I get there, I get there. But God's in control. Perhaps I've learned so many things the hard way in my life that I'm just saying. Do we ever get to the point where we quit arguing and resisting God's will, do what's right, and try to be just as submissive as we're supposed to be? Just a point. Now, 13 years later, and now Isaac, is he born during this day and age? Remember, the promise still stands. God says, I'm going to give you a child. But it's not going to be this one. It's going to be through your wife, Sarah. Who, by the way, is pretty old by now. You're looking over there. Well, I think our childbearing days are over, aren't they, honey? Things naturally happen, don't they, in our life? Well, so God will take care of that. And so it'll be, look at verse 17. And Abram fell upon his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born unto him that is 100 years old? Now we're 14 years into this thing. Sarah, 90 years old. She's 90 years old. Abram said unto God, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. Still arguing with God 13, 14 years later. And then look at what God said in verse 19. Sarah, thy wife shall bear thee a son, indeed, and thou shalt call his name Isaac. He hadn't been born yet. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant and with his seed after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard thee. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation. There's geography right there. And we're still contending with it today. Anybody deny the fact that this... By the way, when did we ever get to a point in our lives, in the world, in history, to when the birth of a child, one child, was not important? This insignificant child, Ishmael, just a handmaid, just a simple little, you know, slip up, maybe the way people would say it today, didn't really mean to get that pregnant, you know, it just didn't. And now we're 21st century? 4,000 something years later. And we're not dealing with this problem through the birth of one child, are we? The potentials, the problems. By the way, another thing too, through the Arabic people, anybody know what great scientific feats and so forth have been accomplished through Ishmael's line? They become tremendous mathematicians. A lot of the math and stuff that we're still doing, from what I understand, don't ask me, I didn't like math too much. But seriously, the Arabic people become tremendously mathematical minded people. And there's a lot of science involved with them. So from that standpoint, did God answer his promise? He sure did. Now, did they get messed up around 600 AD when a guy named Muhammad decided that the Jews and the Christians were both wrong? And decided he started seeing visions and decided, like Joseph Smith, about 1,200 years later, decided he was seeing visions because the Methodists and the Catholics and the Baptists and the Presbyterians weren't getting along up there in New York and all those locations, and he decided he was going to see visions. By the way, I made a Mormon real mad one time. Didn't mean to, but I did. I asked a question. I said, you know, Muhammad had visions too, supposedly, and decided that the Jews and the Christians in 600 needed some help. And then Joseph Smith in 1807 or 30-something or whenever started seeing visions supposedly and saying, you know, these denominations have got it all wrong. They need some help. So I'm going to take it upon myself and I'm going to presume that I can have visions too. And now I'm a prophet and God's told me and you guys come over here and y'all sit over there and I'm going to go in this closet over here, even though the Bible says... Even if an angel, same principles apply to Muhammad. You see, the problem with Muhammad and the problem with Joseph Smith is the exact same. Neither one of them took the Bible and studied it. They took what was going on in the world and they came at religion from the standpoint that people still come at it today. I ain't going down there to that church, bunch of hypocrites in there. Yeah. And that's the wrong approach. Because when you approach things from that vantage and you judge everything based upon me, and you, then your picture's going to be a little bit off, isn't it? You'll never go anywhere. But the interest, that's right, and that brings us back to His will, His word, and He says, you stick with this, I'll get you through this. Now stick with me. That's why Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, few there be that find it. The reason why is because in verse 21 of Matthew 7, after that little context, He says this, well, many are going to say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in thy name? No, Muhammad, you messed up. No, Joseph Smith, you messed up. You did not prophesy. You did not speak my word. You looked at everything from the wrong vantage. Anyway, it all starts right there with that 4,000-year-old, and you can't even really call it a mistake, a choice. And Sarah, look at all the people. That's right. You can't step away and say, well, it's all your fault, Abraham. There wouldn't be a baby if you didn't. Well, okay, maybe so. You got a wife over here saying, you know. So again, we have to analyze things honestly. So there's another slide there. Now, I messed up again. I didn't put the text up. Let's look at Sodom and Gomorrah. Anybody recognize what that picture is on the screen? Don, do you know what that is? I told Don I was going to introduce him into this class. I was going to ask for his help. Help us understand what that is there on the screen. All right. Okay. Thank you. Okay, so that little ball of fire that Don knows more than I do about, that's the location area of they think Sodom and Gomorrah was, okay? That's in the Jordan Valley. Pardon? The plain of the five cities, which in the Bible, when we look at this, it's not really just two cities. These are like metropolitan areas. There were several located peoples and cities and so forth, and a lot going on here. So when you read the scriptures, actually, it wasn't just two, it was a bunch of people, a lot of things going on here. And as a result of, I know, because of their inhospitality. That's the likable argument today presented by the LGBT, whatever they are. Now I love them. We gotta help them, don't we? We gotta help them understand some things. But nonetheless, they take the position that because of an inhospitable situation, that God destroyed them. It's interesting they don't argue against the fact that it was destroyed. Here's another picture. Again, does this confirm kind of what you were talking about? Naturally white sulfur found at Gomorrah, and then there's naturally occurring sulfur from a geothermal region. It kind of shows a difference in what you were saying, I think, the actual percentage, the richness of it. After you and I had talked, I went and looked up some of this, and here's another. There's that picture there, kind of the sulfur ball. And it's found all in this area. They say, and why? You know, again, I don't have to wander too far away. And so just to kind of show you here, brethren, the Bible is very clear about the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Anybody remember just not too long ago, and I'm not sure how they've amended all this in the last 25, 30 years, but they've done a lot of changing in the law books. What did they used to call individuals by the law that were homosexual? Sodomites, sodomy laws. Anybody remember sodomy laws if you were caught? Now, here's the debate. And I don't really want to get into it, but I feel like I need to say something, because it just shows the biblical impact upon our society. Sodomy laws. A nation that is righteous. What does the Bible teach? Righteousness does what to a nation? Exalts a nation. Now, what is righteousness? Is anything that's ungodly righteous? Right with God. Okay, that's great. That's it. Okay, so anything that's not right with God is considered unrighteous, right? So when you come to laws, the authors of your laws going back 100 years, going back 150 years, and so on and so forth, were they perfect men? They messed up on some. They had some, and there was a lot of debating over slavery. I think slavery is the big black mark on our country that we'll probably reap until who knows. But there are a lot of other issues too. But when the laws were being written, when it came to man's moral compass and biological makeup, scientific facts, there's a male, there's a female. There's a male, there's a female. That's a fact, right? So today we're dealing with the fact that a boy is born and he decides, well, I don't want to be a boy anymore. Or a mom and a dad foster that are allowed that because little Johnny likes to play with Barbies. Well, he just liked Barbies, and therefore, because I got a degree from some sophisticated philosophical university and I have a little PhD by my name, I think he's got the right to choose to be whoever he wants to be. No, you don't. You don't, because some things aren't a choice. Here's one. I didn't knock on my mom and dad's head and say, I don't want to be born. Don't do anything and don't make me. I didn't have that choice, did I? And none of us did. We don't have choices. Everybody thinks they got a choice to do. You don't. Not everything's a matter of choice. So, going back to laws and so forth, were sodomy laws based in righteousness? A concern for various things. What have we learned in the homosexual community that is more rampant as far as disease and sickness is concerned, as compared to the mutually consenting, loving, heterosexual families? What is absent? What is very predominantly present? So why doesn't a loving and compassionate politician speak affirmatively about things like that? That's not even a matter of really biblical proportion. That's a matter of just right and wrong. These are just statistical facts. My point being is that God doesn't like it too well, apparently, based upon the lesson we learn at Sodom and Gomorrah, when mankind turns upside down not only moral law, but what other kind of law? God's natural law. Seed time and harvest. God blessed us from the beginning with abundance. One of the amazing things about farming, gardening, and so forth, and I'll quit on this one, is this. The seed produces after its own kind, correct? Anybody ever grown a garden and held back extra or excess seeds? And next year you grow the same garden. And if you keep doing that, you'll eventually have a storehouse, a stock of a lot of seed, because what is God teaching us that He does abundantly every year over and over again as the seasons change cyclically, as they always do, going back to Noah? Seed time and harvest shall remain. Are we ever lacking the abundance of seed? Now think about the gospel. Is there anything lacking in regard to the gospel seed, the power of God unto salvation? Anything lacking? It's so powerful, brethren, that we underestimate it. We pull the same old cards and the same old punches that these brethren have done for millennia. Any comments or questions? And I'll end on that.